Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Rob Ballot, author of the new book Exposure and the subject of the new movie Dark Waters, will join us to discuss his new book and the case that made him an American hero. Tar Bell founder Wendell Potter will join us to discuss what's behind the lack of media coverage on the growing support for Medicare for All. Heather Digby Parton will be here to help me run down this week's and the latest on impeachment hearings. And our progressive candidate spotlight this week will be with Joshua Collins. He's a 25-year-old truck driver running for Congress in Washington's 10th Congressional District. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. There's also a member show, and you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member, getting our three-hour radio show without commercials, and access to 10 years of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up now. Helping me run down the news this week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon.
So, Heather, I think we're both a little bleary-eyed. This has been quite an insane week of testimony on the impeachment hearings. Of course, Democrats are still... There's still a bunch of them running for election, and we still have, some measure of our government rolling along, continuing its practices of attacking immigrants and whatnot. It is a very bizarre period of time. I guess we should just start off by digging into impeachment. The week saw some appointed testimony from Lieutenant Colonel Vidman. He is the NSC expert on Ukraine who was in the White House. with him was also a State Department figure. She was detailed from the State Department into Mike Pence's office. Lost her name in just a matter of moments. At Williams.
Jennifer Williams.
Jennifer Williams. And we should start there. Their testimony was followed by Kurt Volker and Tim Morrison. And then, of course, on the next day, Gordon Sondland. And Sondland dropped the big bombs. But let's start at the beginning of the week with Vindman, because this was... maybe let's just step back and talk about the Democrats' strategy overall as you see it.
Well, I think their strategy is, and I think they're actually doing it pretty effectively, is to just sort of, they got this testimony, which obviously it's actually even getting worse than it was originally from all these people, as people like Volker and Sondland amend their earlier testimony in light of what they're seeing, as the testimony was released publicly. They're obviously going, ooh, I better cover myself, and they are coming back and making it clearer. And I think that, in a normal court of law, they would be you know, liable for some problems unless the prosecutor said, okay, you've got one more chance to do this right, or you'll be accused of perjury. But in this case, they just want to get to the truth here, I think. They want to get to the bottom line. So they're rolling out this testimony, I think, and it, you know, I had my doubts about it, but, you know, what do I know? They seem to have a good sense of how to let this story unfold daily with some new stuff that is revealing, and also their sense of these witnesses and how they, you know, how they come across and what they were going to present to the American public. They seem to be doing that pretty well. And of course, you know, what they're leading up to is a point where they're going to turn over what they found in these hearings to the Judiciary Committee, which is where the actual impeachment articles will be drafted and released, at which point Pelosi has said others from the other committees and the Judiciary Committee will also add what they have to add to it, and we don't know what that might be, and potentially parts of the Mueller report, which are already, they're just laid out, you know, in full with people under oath. I mean, there's no problem there. And then we'll see what happens after that. So I think these hearings have been pretty effective. I mean, it's dry stuff, but for those of us who are political junkies, the kind of people who would watch them in depth and in detail, I think are finding them pretty riveting. And those who aren't, I think at the end of the day, there is, has been so far a storyline that is coherent that people can understand, which is what's unfolding here. We're getting closer and closer to the president. And in a weird way, that kind of tracks with the way the Watergate hearings unfolded as well. They went over a longer period of time, but that was the strategy on the part of the Democrats, was to bring it into the Oval Office and then bring it directly to the White House, to the president. And ultimately, of course, they had the revelation that there were tapes, which changed everything. But nonetheless, that was the way it was. And in fact, it's kind of interesting because, you know, the myth about the Watergate hearings was that Howard Baker, you know, he was the great guy, the great Republican who crossed over and whatever, and he was out there. What did the president know, and when did he know it? And people think that was about him really grilling the witnesses to, you know, tell us, what did he know? The reality is the opposite. He thought the president was home free and that he had didn't know anything, and that he was sort of the protector of the president, which is what you're seeing from Republicans now. And the Sondland testimony in particular, he was the first one who came out and said, hey, the president knew, you know, I was talking to him on the phone, and he told Julie we had to talk to Rudy, and we all assumed and knew that Rudy was speaking for the president, et cetera, and brought it right to the president. And, you know, that's what they're doing. They're saying, well, he didn't really know about it, right? I mean, he didn't tell you, he didn't look you in the eye and say quid pro quo, did he? You know, so it's the same kind of thing that the Republicans are trying to do as they did back in Watergate. And it didn't work very well then either, because now we have people coming forward who are saying, you know, exactly what happened. And of course, Sondland didn't just implicate the president, although he said he never told him directly. He did implicate the Secretary of State, the Chief of Staff, and the former NSC Director John Bolton. So all of that is kind of starting to churn around. People are wondering, I think maybe, you know, you've got people like Ken Starr over on Fox News saying, well, this is bad, you know, the president looks bad for the president. Is somebody going to be walking up to the White House and telling him it's time to resign, which is kind of a shocking thing because Starr has been right, totally, you know, pro-Trump. So in any case, I think that this is unfolding. I don't know if you can plan this. You know, I don't know if anybody can sort of predict or control these events, but I think they've done a pretty good job so far. It's only been, you know, a week, so we'll see what happens. But I think we've gotten a lot of new information over the past couple of weeks that really do lead to this. And of course, the specter hanging over all of this, and the thing which Republicans are constantly reminding us of, is that, you know, the Russia investigation foreshadowed this whole thing. I mean, the 2016 election foreshadowed it. And in fact, this particular, you know, series of events has to do with the 2016 election. I mean, you've got, right, you know, it's not just about Biden. It's about this silly conspiracy theory they've cooked up. So that shadow is hanging over the whole thing, the Russia and the Mueller investigation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, well, we'll take a break here. And I just want to continue on this before we start going over some of the specifics of the different testimonies. But I think clearly what we're seeing is a similar MO, right, in terms of, you know, just using a different apparatus because now he's president. In terms of getting that outside information. But it's still, I think there's still a question in my mind, what was behind their desire to find this out about 2016? That still sits in my head, and I feel like that's an unresolved question that really has not been addressed in the impeachment hearings, and I don't know how it could be. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. We'll take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Talking to the great Digby, and we'll be back in a moment.
Hey everyone, this is Farron Cousins, the host of Ring of Fire on YouTube.com/TheRingOfFire, and the holiday shopping season is officially upon us, so I encourage everyone out there, if you're looking for the perfect gift for a friend, family member, or even for yourself, go to MikePapantonio.com where you can order all three of Mike's novels, Law and Disorder, Law and Vengeance, and the latest, Law and Addiction, which is tackling the opioid crisis from a perspective of both fiction with a lot of reality tied in. All three books are available right now for purchase. And if you want to get your order in before the holidays, again, go to MikePapantonio.com and place your order. These are great books written by a truly great progressive and legal mind. You do not want to miss out on this. So again, MikePapantonio.com. Order all three books in the Law and Disorder series.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Digby doing an impeachment update. So, Heather, at the end of the last segment, you know, we had talked about, and you had made the connection that much of the accusations regarding the that were implicit in the Mueller report were sort of, I guess, there was an analog in terms of what Trump was setting up to do in the 2020 election, which was to get, to get a foreign government. To force a foreign government to provide a false narrative. And it's fascinating. I mean, we're going to jump around in, as we talk about the impeachment testimony. But one of the things that came out during the Sondland testimony, which I think was implicit, and frankly, I had this sense just when we were looking at the text messages weeks ago, but this was confirmed, is that the administration, and by that I mean Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani, even though he's not in the administration, all of the Trump people, they did not seem to be terribly interested in an actual investigation. What they were really interested in was the statement that an investigation was going on, which shows that, you know, which again undercuts, you know, to the extent that we really need more evidence of that. But it undercuts the assertion that they were interested in actual corruption investigations. They wanted, what they wanted was a statement that they were investigating the Bidens, period. I mean, that's ultimately what they wanted. But they also wanted one about 2016. And it's perfectly conceivable for me to imagine that Donald Trump's ego, and maybe I'm using the wrong term, I'm not a psychiatrist, but whatever dysfunction he has inside him that drives him, and again, you know, this is speculation. I'm just trying to come up with why would it be so urgent to have this investigation into 2016 that you would leverage this on the phone with the president of Ukraine, that you would hold back military assistance when you know you've already, as far as you're concerned, been exonerated, that there's going to be no action taken on the Mueller report? Why would it be so urgent to get this information about 2016? And it seems to me that this has been sort of unexplored, because it really does. And I don't know how one would go about to sort of understand this, but I'm not convinced that their so-called investigation into 2016 and the statement wasn't also an attempt to have a predicate about 2020, that maybe in the event that they lost, that this plan to influence the election out of Ukraine was happening again in some way. I don't know. I mean, this is just pure speculation, but that is stuck in my craw and I can't quite work it out. I don't know if you have any theories about that.
Well, I don't. I have the same question, and I've you know, written a few things about it, just sort of questioning what, you know, what is this that you know, what does Trump really want? What does he want here? I'm perfectly willing, as you are, to accept that he's a narcissist, egomaniac who just simply has to have some, you know, alternate explanation for 2016, and that it's not possible that the Russians actually intervened on his behalf. I think it's also partially, you know,
I mean, that would be analogous to him saying there were 3 million illegal immigrants,
illegal
votes that came up into New Hampshire from Massachusetts, and then he's going to go about and start a whole commission on it with Kris Kobach. I mean, that would be consistent with his behavior.
Yeah, and I don't doubt that you know, it plays into it for sure. And you know, there's also the idea that, you know, I think he believes that he, you know, Manafort and Giuliani may have very well convinced him that Ukraine was behind the firing of Manafort, which he may consider to be, you know, one of the oranges of the Russia investigation, as he once put it, you know. So he may blame Ukraine. I mean, there's been reporting and I think some of the testimony that says that he just really hates the country, thinks they're horrible people, and, you know, is just disgusted by them in general. And perhaps that is part of it, that he thinks that they somehow helped to sabotage him, and is convinced that, you know, they should be, you know, he feels like justified in strong-arming them to help him out. You know, and it's entirely possible. Look, you know, at virtually everything Trump does on foreign policy has accrued to the benefit of Vladimir Putin. I mean, this just goes without saying. I don't know what that is. Maybe it's coincidence. Maybe Trump just somehow has a good feeling that leads him in that direction. I don't know. But that is part of this, too, because this very much benefits Russia in kind of muddying the waters around what they did in 2016 and, frankly, kind of giving a green light for them to do it again in 2020. And by the way, the Republican Party itself now, by pushing this alternate reality, are essentially, you know, they're degrading, you know, everyone's confidence in the intelligence community in the United States and among our allies, and pretty much saying to the Russians, hey, you know, we're not looking. You know, we don't believe you guys did it. We believe it was Ukraine. I mean, you've got Devin Nunes up there daily,
right,
doing long diatribes about how it was really Ukraine. I mean, so they've bought into this whole thing, too, largely, I think, to protect Donald Trump, and they're not the brightest people in the world. And they also, you know, I think they need the help. They're happy to take the help from Russia, assuming that it's going to go in their direction. I don't think they're being very wise there, because it might not go in their direction. But nonetheless, I don't think Russia really cares about the Republican Party or Donald Trump. You know, if they are interfering, it's for their own benefit. And who knows what they think that is. But at this point, you know, it is very difficult to know why he has these petty obsessions. And he has a bunch of them.
Yep.
This was one. And, you know, I think, you know, and some of it too, Sam, you know, you've known people who are really way in over there. You've worked with them, I'm sure, way in over their head on their job. So they just
find
something to focus on.
They latch on to one thing as some type of talisman. All right. Well, listen, Heather, we got to take a break. You and I will continue our discussion of this in the next hour. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Be back after this. Coming up, attorney Rob Balot will join us to discuss his new book, Exposure. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, today's show was made possible in part by BetterHelp. BetterHelp is an online service. It gives you unlimited access to your own fully licensed therapist by way of phone, video, and chat. And they're giving Ring of Fire listeners 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. That's BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. Look, this is how it works. You get paired up, and you'll be communicating with your therapist within 24 hours of signing up. You don't have to go into an office. You can do it from your home or wherever. If you're on the go, it doesn't matter. You can log into your account anytime and send messages to your therapist. You'll get a timely and thoughtful response. You can schedule your live meetings at any time that fit your schedule. And if you don't think your therapist is working out, if it's not a great match, you can switch to someone new at any time for no extra charge. It's more affordable than traditional in-person therapy. Financial aid is available, and you'll get 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Our next guest is the subject of a new movie, Dark Waters, starring the great Mark Ruffalo, that opened in theaters this week, and here to discuss the case that led to a major Hollywood movie and discuss his new book, Exposure, Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 20-Year Battle Against DuPont, attorney Rob Balot. Rob, I appreciate your being with us. I know that you right now, in particular, with the release of this film about your experience, Dark Waters, released your experience in this case with DuPont, has got you pretty busy, so I appreciate the time. Let's just, if you would, I mean, recount to us what the origins of this were, because I don't think people appreciate just how long of a saga this really is.
Sure. And, you know, thanks for having me on. You know, we're talking about a story that really began over 20 years ago, the fall of 1998, when I had a gentleman call me from West Virginia telling me about cows dying on his property. And at the time, you know, I was working at my law firm in Cincinnati, where I was primarily representing corporations and including a lot of big chemical companies. So I was, you know, actually working sort of on what you would call the defense side. And so this was not the kind of case that I typically handled, but he was telling me that he was having all kinds of problems with his cows. He had hundreds of cows that were dying. He was seeing white foaming water, dead deer, all kinds of problems with wildlife in the area. And could I just take a look at what he had? And, you know, I frankly had no idea what he was talking about, but then he blurted out the name of my grandmother, that he had gotten my name from my grandmother. My mom's family had grown up in the area. This is right outside Parkersburg, West Virginia, along the Ohio River. So when I heard that he had been referred to me through my grandmother, I said, sure, bring all your information, bring it on up, we'll take a look. That was fall of 1998, and he came up to our offices in Cincinnati, and we watched his videotapes that went back several years and looked at all his photographs, and it was pretty clear there was something really bad going on, something really wrong. We saw animals with deformities, with blacker teeth, tumors, dead wildlife in the area, white foaming water coming out of a discharge pipe. So, you know, it looked like something we could help them with. We would pull the permits and look at what kind of hazardous materials were dumped in this landfill, and we thought we could get to the bottom of it pretty quickly for him. And that was 20 years ago. We had no idea at the time that when we took that case on, it would actually lead to the discovery of a completely unregulated, virtually unknown chemical that was in the water called PFOA. And it's now, we've been working on that and trying to bring attention to what we've learned about this chemical for the last 20 years.
All right. So it's a PFOA. Give us the, to some extent, I mean, we've talked about this on this show over the years, but give us a sense of what this chemical is. It was, it's a chemical that was basically sold to DuPont at one point as a way of making non-stickware pans, right?
Correct. We're talking about a chemical that was invented right after World War II. You know, it did not exist on the planet prior to World War II, really invented by the 3M company, and came out decades. We're talking decades before there was a US EPA, which didn't even form until 1970. And this chemical, completely synthetic, man-made chemical that had an unusually strong chemical bond, carbons attached to a fluorine, which made it extremely stable compound, hard to break down, but which made it very useful for certain manufacturing processes. It was used as what they call a surfactant. And DuPont discovered, you know, that it was particularly useful in their manufacturing of Teflon. And so they began buying it from DuPont as early as 1951 and had large quantities of it shipped from 3M in Minnesota down to Parkersburg, West Virginia, where they used it in making Teflon at what was really the world's largest Teflon manufacturing facility in Parkersburg, right along the Ohio River.
Now, we should say you've described this as being incredibly durable, the chemical, having bonds that have a very short half-life. It's a chemical that was invented after World War II. But my understanding is that I've never met probably a human being who doesn't have some of this in their blood.
Yeah, you know, and this the same unique chemical structure that made it so useful for various industrial processes also made it extremely troublesome from an environmental and health perspective. You know, the companies realized that this particular chemical structure, it had a chemical bond, this carbon-fluorine bond, made it almost impossible to break this chemical down. So when it was released out into the environment, it would essentially stay there forever. You hear it referred to now as a forever chemical because once it's out in the environment, it doesn't break down under natural biological conditions. So not only does it get out into the environment and stay in our environment, in our water, in our soil, but it also has an unusual ability of being absorbed into living things. And when it gets into these living things, it gets basically sticks to the blood. So we're talking about a chemical that is extremely persistent. You know, will stay out there for long periods of time, but also would accumulate. It gets into our blood, and even the smallest amounts will build up to higher and higher levels over time. And so, you know, the companies realized this decades ago, you know, that this chemical would not only stay in the environment, but if people were exposed to it, it would get in and stay in people and build up. And then, unfortunately, they also started realizing it was toxic, it had all kinds of toxic effects in laboratory studies. In fact, DuPont even internally classified it as a confirmed animal carcinogen in the 1980s and started monitoring workers and seeing cancer increases in workers. And, you know, unfortunately, all this information we've been talking about, most of it was unfortunately kept within internal company documents, and the public that was being exposed to this chemical in their air and the water and in products, you know, wasn't told. And the government regulators really weren't told. It wasn't until our litigation, you know, for this farmer in West Virginia, where we discovered, you know, this information in internal documents. And I started trying to make that information available to the public and to the EPA as early as 2001, trying to warn that we're looking at a massive public health threat here, talking about a chemical that's getting out into the environment and into people on a massive scale, worldwide scale.
So now we know that it was so dangerous that at one point 3M decided we don't want to be in this business anymore. But prior to that, they had told DuPont that there was a specific way they had to dispose of this because it was such a what you call a forever chemical. What was that they told them before we go to the break? What was it that they told them, and what did DuPont end up doing instead?
Yeah, 3M actually provided instructions to DuPont when it provided this chemical to them, basically warning them not to dispose of it into waterways, and that the, you know, not to dump it out into the ground, and the only proper way really to get rid of it was to incinerate it. And unfortunately, DuPont did not abide by those guidelines, and they instead continued to dump it into the ground, into unlined pits, around their plant in West Virginia, where it seeped into the groundwater and discharged it directly out into the Ohio River and into the air for decades.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will hear how a case that you first started litigating in the late 20th century went well into the 21st century before it was resolved. I'm Sam Seder. We're talking to Rob Bellott. He is the subject in many respects, or I guess he is a protagonist played by Mark Ruffalo in the new film Dark Waters, which is out near you. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Sam Seder, Ring of Fire Radio.
62 UJ5. Is anybody out there alive? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Out on the highway of the dark side of the moon.
We are back, Ring of Fire Radio. I am talking to Rob Bellott. He is the subject of a film called Dark Waters, or I should say he is portrayed by Mark Ruffalo as a protagonist in the film Dark Waters. And, of course, based upon his experience and in part, at least the story is also told in his own book, Exposure, Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 20-Year Battle. And, Rob, when we took the break, you had basically told us at least the beginnings of that battle. A farmer came to you. You were at the time a lawyer that would more or less defend chemical companies. You took this case by this farmer because he was referred to by your grandmother. And I'm curious, before we get into like the process of how we went from that one case in West Virginia to the ultimate case that caused DuPont to pay an enormous sum for the damage that they had incurred. Well, I'm curious as to like your personal, the dynamic of you having had defended some of these companies to becoming an attorney for a plaintiff against these companies. Like was there any drama involved in that, or was it just like, well, it's another job?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that presented a number of its own challenges, as you can imagine, and you see a lot of them. You see a lot of that portrayed in the movie Dark Waters, and I go into a lot of that detail as well in the book Exposure. But, you know, once I started digging in to these documents, and once we started realizing that we were looking at, you know, contamination that went far beyond just this one farmer and his family's property, but, you know, we were looking at contamination of the entire community's drinking water, and that it was contamination that was likely all over the country and in the blood of Americans everywhere. You know, I began to realize I might be one of the only people outside of the company that had seen these documents. The government wasn't aware. The public wasn't aware. And, you know, I really began to view this as a public health threat that we really needed. We had an obligation to alert the public that this was happening and to do what we could, given the information we had and likely others didn't have, you know, to try to do what we could to get this out of the water there and to alert the rest of the country as to what was happening. And luckily, I was at a law firm, Taft, Stettinius & Hollister, where I am still there. It's now my 29th year, looked at this same information and agreed, you know, that this was bad. And this was something that we were going to take on and we were going to make sure was properly addressed, and they stuck with it for many, many years, because this was a long process. I was fortunate to be at a firm that really understood the gravity of what we had uncovered and was, you know, willing to stand by it for a long period of time.
So what happened? So you went in with this one case with the farmer, and then you realized that this contamination was not limited to just what this farmer experienced with his cows, and he passed on, my understanding is, of cancer.
Correct.
In the course of that settlement, there was sort of an unprecedented committee set up that was set out to determine, at least within a certain radius of that DuPont factory, how many people had maybe gotten ill from the improper disposal of that PFOA chemical.
That's right. You know, we were dealing with a chemical that had essentially gone under the radar of the regulators for decades. So when we were discovering all this, it was unregulated. And we, as lawyers, had to figure out, how do we get this out of the water? How do we get relief for these people when we're not going to be able to really do it through the regulatory system, through the governmental system? We had to do it, as lawyers, trying to figure out how we can do it, through the legal system. And despite everything we were seeing in the company's own documents about the toxicity, the potential health effects, we still had the company denying the results of those studies that presented any risk. So we were able to eventually reach a settlement with DuPont in 2004, where we agreed that both sides would sit down and pick completely independent scientists who would look at all of the data, not just what was out there in the published peer-reviewed literature, a lot of which, had been unfortunately sort of controlled by the companies, but all of the internal studies as well, and not only look at the existing data, but do new studies. Look at what this chemical was actually doing to the people drinking it in those communities. This was something that really had never been done before, to our knowledge. We weren't really sure, how long it would take or how many people would even participate. Right. We ended up, there was a payment by DuPont that we ended up using to pay people in the community to come forward, have their blood drawn, and provide information. And we ended up getting 69,000 people in that community.
Wow.
Who came forward, had their blood drawn, provided medical information, turned it over to these scientists, who then spent the next 7 years conducting some of the biggest human health studies ever done on any chemical.
Wow.
And we were able to then independently confirm through this scientific panel that drinking the chemical was linked with 6 diseases, including 2 types of cancer.
Wow. And that led to, how many people were actually in that, class of people who were harmed, at least directly, that were established through that process?
Well, we had estimated that the number of folks in that area that were contaminated by the time of the settlement, this chemical had turned up in 6 different public water supplies on the Ohio and West Virginia side of the river, and dozens of people with private wells. We estimated that total area of about 70,000 people. We ended up getting 69,000 of them to participate in the study. So it was a incredibly huge sampling from within that community. I mean, you had 69 of the 70,000 people participate. So it provided unprecedented data in order to finally confirm independently what we had frankly been seeing in the documents from the company for many years.
We just have about a minute and a half left. I mean, how many plaintiffs ultimately were involved in this case?
Well, once those links came out in 2012, they were announced at the finalized in 2012, we ended up with about 3,500 people in that community that had one of these 6 diseases. And we ended up, all those cases were consolidated in a proceeding in Columbus, Ohio. They started going to trial in 2015. We won all the first 3 trials, including punitive damages. And during the 4th trial, DuPont finally agreed to settle all of the pending cases for about $670.7 million. That was in 2017.
Wow. And we just have about 40 seconds left. I'm curious as to that sort of unprecedented epidemiology study. Is that a model for future litigation or for future investigations into these chemicals? Like I say, we have about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I think it should be. In fact, I've just filed a new case in federal court in Ohio, because now that we know about PFOA, we're finding a number of these related PFAS chemicals from the same chemical family in water and human blood. And we're hearing the companies go back to that old refrain, well, there's no evidence showing what they do to human health. So I filed a case on behalf of everyone in the I'm seeking to have it be a class action on behalf of everyone in the country with these chemicals in their blood. And the goal is not money. But the goal is to have the court require these companies to actually set up a new nationwide panel to look at all of these PFAS chemicals and once again, independently confirm what they are in fact doing to us. Do that through independent scientists.
Rob Ballot, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Rob Ballot is the author of the new book, Exposure, Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 20-Year Battle Against DuPont. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more of the impeachment hearings from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, check out ROFpodcast.com to become a member.
It's in my blood, it's in my water. You tried to tame me from the start.